Welcome to Clinical Conversations, a Journal Watch podcast, for the week ending March 26th. This is podcast number 80. For links to earlier podcasts, go to podcasts.jwatch.org. I'm Joe Elia. This time we check in with an unusual cross-manufacturer attempt to see whether use of bisphosphonates in osteoporosis leads to atypical fractures of the femur. News first. And we begin with the New England Journal of Medicine's release online of a Dutch study showing that when it comes to preventing recurrent miscarriage, aspirin, either alone or with heparin, doesn't have any effect. In a randomized study comprising over 350 women who'd had at least two miscarriages, aspirin and the combination of aspirin and subcutaneous low molecular weight heparin did no better than placebo. Next, B-type natriuretic peptides seem promising as a guide for titrating medications in heart failure, according to a meta-analysis from Archives of Internal Medicine. During a mean follow-up of 17 months, patients in BNP-guided therapy showed a reduced risk for mortality relative to controls. The benefit was limited mainly to patients under age 76. Next, Pediatrics has some practical advice for parents of children with food allergies. In brief, have those children carry two EpiPens. The suggestion comes from a chart review of two Boston emergency departments over a six-year period. More than 10% of kids with anaphylaxis who received epinephrine needed two doses over the course of their treatment. And finally, speaking of children, the FDA is telling clinicians to stop using the rotavirus vaccine Rotarix temporarily. It's been found to be contaminated with a putatively harmless porcine circovirus. The other rotavirus vaccine, called Rotatec, is not known to have been contaminated. That's the news. Now, here's this week's conversation. You're listening to Clinical Conversations. This week, the New England Journal of Medicine released online a study addressing the question of whether the use of bisphosphonates paradoxically leads to atypical fractures of the femur in patients with osteoporosis. Two manufacturers pooled the results of three trials comprising over 14,000 patients and re-examined fractures occurring on the femoral shaft. Although a slightly higher risk was observed, it didn't achieve statistical significance, and the small number of fractures found made the confidence intervals around that risk very wide. We've got three of the paper's academic authors as our conversation partners today. Dr. Dennis Black is professor of epidemiology and biostatistics at the University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Michael Kelly is chief resident in the Department of Orthopedic Surgery at UCSF. And Dr. Douglas Bauer is a general internist and a professor of medicine and of epidemiology and biostatistics, also at UCSF. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Dr. Black, let me start by asking, how did you get the manufacturer's cooperation in this research, and was it their idea to do it?
Well, we've actually worked with both Merck and Novartis right from the beginning on these large clinical trials, Merck starting in 1992 and with Novartis starting in about 2000. So we were the sort of coordinating center for these three trials. So we had all the data in-house. It was really Dr. Bowers and my idea to actually do this analysis, retrospective analysis, starting in 2008.
And Dr. Kelly, as a surgeon, what's your experience been with bisphosphonates, and what did you expect that the re-examination of that data might find?
Well, I didn't have any preconceived ideas of what it was going to show. I thought it may show an increased risk, but given that they are so rare, I didn't know if we were going to have enough patients. Our experience, incidentally, was that we had one of these fractures in our clinic. And my attending, who is a spine surgeon, said, oh, you should write that up. And the next thing, I was reading Dr. Black and Dr. Bauer's papers and sending them emails, and then this happened.
Yeah. Well, and you mentioned the number of patients. There were 14,000, and in that combined group from the trials, there were something, if I recall, about 280 fractures, mm-hmm. of which right. about a dozen qualified as fractures of interest. Those were fractures on the femoral shaft. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. And
okay, Doug, do you want to expand on that a little bit?
Well, I would just point out that the reports that we were responding to for this were atypical fractures, and that fractures in the location of this hip area, which are actually just between the hip and the mid part of the thigh, in fact, are relatively infrequent. And what prompted this research was reports, case reports and individual reports of a number of unfortunate individuals who'd had fractures after taking bisphosphonate for a long period of time. But what was important about our study is that these previous studies were not in the setting of a controlled trial, and of course there was no placebo-treated individuals in those previous studies. That's what piqued our interest to look at this in the data that we already had available to us.
Let me ask you a question. There was I know that you started this re-examination of the data a couple of years ago almost.
Correct.
And just recently, the FDA put out a kind of a reassurance notice that it was looking at this question and found nothing. And it was within 2 weeks, I think, that the New England Journal of Medicine released your study online. Do you know if there was any connection between those two events?
Well, I believe the sequence of events that have happened over the last couple months was that there were some abstracts presented at the American Association of Orthopedic Surgery that were picked up by the media, and that sort of prompted the FDA to do another re-examination. They'd already done an examination of these fractures, I think, sometime last year,
mm-hmm.
to do something else. We had actually submitted our paper, however, before all this happened. We submitted the paper in January,
okay.
and New England Journal had already positively reviewed it. But what did happen is I believe the publication probably got accelerated because of the interest.
Oh, okay.
But it was already decided to publish it.
Oh, okay. It's one of the advantages of the new publishing platforms that when news comes out that makes a paper more relevant to the readership, it's easier to put it out, and that seems to be what they've done there. Okay.
Well, yes, I would agree. It's a huge change from, say, 10 years ago in terms of the ability to quickly get information out to people.
Yes.
But Dennis is right. We actually did start these analyses, I think, about 2 years ago, and what was interesting is that there wasn't much interest in this whole topic back then, but we felt it was important to at least see if we could go back within the data that we had available to us to see if we could find any of these unusual fractures, particularly in the people that had received bisphosphonates. But it really wasn't until we were able to, I think, combine the studies as we did in the New England Journal paper that it really allowed us to make some inferences about how likely these fractures are.
I'm not a biostatistician, but I've learned over time just on the street to learn to look at confidence intervals, and so these are some of the widest confidence intervals I've ever seen. But that aside, do those results, Dr. Black, let me ask you, are those results pointing to anything other than the fact that these are rare fractures?
Well, I think the fact that they're very rare, and then the specific rate we came up with in all these studies combined was about 2 per 10,000 person years of follow-up,
mm-hmm.
in these osteoporotic patients. I think the fact that these events are rare compared to the frequency of the fractures that are prevented in osteoporotic women sort of tips the balance in favor of treatment, even under some of the more severe scenarios about the potential effects of bisphosphonate on these femur fractures. So that was one of the main points that we tried to make is, again, in these osteoporotic patients, only the patients in these trials, we figured if you treat 1,000 women, you prevent about 100 fractures. And in sort of the worst case we considered in terms of association with additional femur fractures, you might be associated with 1 to 2 additional femur fractures. So the balance seems strongly in favor of treatment.
Dr. Bauer, what use might clinicians make of your findings? Is there anything in particular that they ought to be doing differently next week, say, than they were doing this week?
Well, I think one thing is that this paper should provide some level of confidence and reassurance to both clinicians as well as patients that this is not a likely event among individuals who are similar to those that were in the three studies that were studied in the trials, which is, for the most part, postmenopausal women that had moderate to advanced osteoporosis and took the medications between 3 and 10 years. So I think that's reassuring because many of the press reports that I've seen have really created a little bit of hysteria that that there was going to be an epidemic and that the benefit of this drug would be completely eliminated by these additional fractures, and I think our study really suggests that's unlikely to be true. I do believe that the question is still open about how frequent these fractures occur, as well as whether there might be other risk factors, such as taking other medications at the same time, such as corticosteroids, that might increase the likelihood of one of these unfortunate complications of taking the medication. But I think for most practitioners and most patients, studies such as this one should be reassuring that our prescribing habits really should not be altered on the basis of the concern about these subtrochanteric fractures.
Would you advise clinicians who are looking after patients with osteoporosis and are on bisphosphonates to examine the complete drug history just so that they know there's none of these, that there aren't any of these other things?
I think that's always a good idea. The problem is to know what the relative risks and benefits are, and right now we have absolutely no information about that.
Yeah.
So there have been some suggestions that these other medications and other conditions, particularly rheumatologic conditions, might predispose individuals to this complication, but there's so little data there. I really believe that clinicians need to continue their current use of these medications and not change them until we have additional studies that provide some true evidence about that.
So, Dr. Kelly, you're a surgeon and you see some of these breaks yourself. What advice have you got for clinicians?
It's important for the clinicians to understand that the study doesn't say that there's no association between these fractures and the use of bisphosphonates. The study says that they're extremely rare and we couldn't find an association. But given the preponderance of case reports with prodromal pain and then people breaking their femurs with no energy, that anyone prescribing a bisphosphonate should have it on their radar, especially if a patient comes in complaining of hip or thigh pain, to get x-rays. Because to fix a broken bone is a lot harder than to put a nail in a bone that has not yet broken.
Okay. Well, that's good advice. I want to thank the three of you, Dr. Dennis Black, Dr. Michael Kelly, and Dr. Douglas Bauer, for your time with us today.
Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Joe.
That's it for this week. You can reach Clinical Conversations at 1-617-440-4374. Earlier podcasts are available at podcasts.jwatch.org, where links for all news stories are also found. Clinical Conversations executive producer is Adore Yano, and I'm Joe Ilya. Join us next time, and thanks for listening.